Charlie Kavanagh is a very well-known sailor in Ireland and a former Commodore of Wicklow Sailing Club. Last summer, he took a five-month cruise from Wexford to Sweden, much of it through inland waterways. He's been giving a series of talks to the Cruising Association of Ireland about his adventures, and he told me this afternoon about his trip and the motivation behind it.
Well, back in 2013, I took on two deliveries to take boats to Sweden, one to Stockholm and one to Ystad, both of them from Northern Ireland. And it was quite an adventure. And I got a glimpse of the Baltic through those trips. And it was my intention to always come back and explore a bit further.
Tell me something about your own boat. It's a 34-foot yacht.
Yeah, it's a Sadler 34, 1984, so it's a little bit on the old side at this stage, but a very good sea boat. I've had it since 2008, and it looks after me very well.
What's she called?
Stravager. It's a Scottish word, meaning to amble gently over the hills.
Okay. which you decided to do last summer. You left Wexford, and your first stop was on the Scilly Isles down off the coast of Cornwall.
That's correct, yeah. We had a little bit of adventure on the way down. I nearly thought I had broken my arm, but things worked out okay. And we arrived into the Scillies and ended up having to pay for a mooring that we only literally sat on for the night, and it was quite an extravagant cost.
What are the Scilly Isles like? They're very close to Wexford.
Yeah, I've been there several times. A beautiful little archipelago of islands, gorgeous little channels, quite tidal. You have to be very careful with the passages through them. They're part of the Duchy of Cornwall, so Prince Charles has ownership of them, and my fee went to him. From there, it was over across to Brittany. We had a very flat passage across the English Channel. No wind, no waves or anything, and the sun was shining the whole way. We got to Roscoff, a ferry port there on the North Brittany coast, and we had a lovely couple of days there. And then from there, we sailed up to Les Ardrues.
You're kind of going through the English Channel there. It's a very busy part of the world.
Yes, it's not so busy down on the Brittany coast, but yes, when you get up past the Cherbourg area, it gets very busy.
How do you avoid all those ferries?
You just have to keep a sharp lookout and just hope that the weather is good, because fog is a real killer in that sort of circumstance. Well, I don't have radar. I have one-way AIS. I can see other vessels on my AIS, which links into my tablet on my Navionics, so that's a useful aid.
Okay, so these ships, they're broadcasting what they are, and then you can see them on your chart plotter in front of you.
Yeah, that's correct, and it's pretty efficient, so it works very well for me.
Where did you go to next?
Les Ardrues. Spent a couple of nights there. We were weather bound, and from there up along towards the Channel Islands, we took up a mooring on Sark. The mooring we picked up was a ferry mooring, and the rope was very thick and very difficult to get on board, but we managed to do it in the middle of the night in the dark. And we just overnighted there, and then across the Alderney Race, which was an interesting experience. It's supposedly the fastest running tide or current in the around Britain. So it's quite strong. It gets up to 8 knots at times.
Dangerous?
Yeah, but we picked a time when we had wind and tide with us, so basically it wasn't too bad, but the water was bubbling with all these whirlypool things all around us as we crossed it. So it was very interesting to see it.
Now, you went up along the coast of Belgium, but then you took into the canal system.
Yeah, we in the Netherlands, we joined at Vlissingen. Some people might know it as Flushing. And we from there was a massive sea lock that took us into the canal system. And from there up to the local regional capital called Middelburg, where I had some friends, and we spent a couple of days there. And then we followed the canals and the inner seas, the blocked off diked seas that are now all through the west coast of the Netherlands, and various rivers and canals and more locks and more bridges up through into the Holland Deep. The Holland Deep is one of the major commercial waterways where a large proportion of the shipping, mostly industrial shipping, comes into the Netherlands. There's huge factory outlets around that area, and the fourth biggest port in Europe is in that area. The name escapes me now.
And so that's all inland, essentially?
Yeah, my entire trip through the Netherlands was inland. It was all through lakes, canals, rivers, the whole way through.
And you have a boat with an ordinary keel. You probably draw maybe about 1.5 meters. And you were able to keep the mast up the whole time.
Yeah, it's a very well organized system. It's called the Standing Mast Route, and it's marked out for navigators to be able to work their way through the Netherlands, so you don't go into blind alleys with fixed bridges or whatever. And it was I don't think I took a wrong turning the whole way through, so it was very well marked and very enjoyable experience. Now, at times I was on my own all the time. At times traffic was very busy with all the Dutch commercial barges and ships working up and down the channels, and that could be a bit unnerving because it'd be coming fast. You know, I'd be doing 5 knots, they'd be doing 8, 9 knots, and sure, the wash going by.
When you're navigating these, are you relying on a chart, an electronic or paper chart, or are there signposts?
There are signposts. There are supplied charts, which I bought for to do the passage, dedicated standing mast route charts. And also I had my chart plotter with Navionics, which was perfectly good doing the trip as well. So I had both visual charts and electronic charts.
What kind of an experience is it? Because here in Ireland, people might think of, you know, the Shannon or something. Is it obviously is very, very different.
I haven't really done the Irish Canal system, but I've done other canals. I did the Caledonian Canal or whatever, and it's completely different because basically the amount of commercial traffic on it just completely changes the whole scene. But when you get off the main routes into the quieter areas, it's quite beautiful. You're going along on your own through lovely countryside. You have the windmills around you. Unfortunately, I missed tulip season by about a week, so I didn't have the benefit of seeing the beautiful tulip fields. I went through, I took a westerly route up through Haarlem to get into Amsterdam, and I had a marina berth right in the centre of Amsterdam. Very reasonable. I think it was about 22 or 3 euro a night. Dunleary, take note. And it was a fabulous location. We had free ferries across to the main centre of Amsterdam at the bus the train station there, and access to the whole of the city right on my doorstep.
From there, you went through Germany.
Yeah, once I got out through Friesland, I got out into the North Sea again, then the Frisian Islands, and I had a very interesting Riddle of the Sands experience on the Frisian Islands, which are the German end of the Frisian Islands. And from there then into the Eider River. I chose to go via the Eider River as opposed to doing the whole Kiel Canal, as I wanted to just experience the rural countryside and whatever. And it turned out to be a brilliant experience to do the Eider River instead of the Kiel Canal.
You gave a talk to the Irish Cruising Club and you described the countryside you came across there.
Yeah, it's about 80 miles long. There are a couple of towns of no major consequence, so it's pretty much a rural landscape the whole way through. You have the farm animals, you have all the wildlife, beautiful river scenery, just a magical experience.
You're making people jealous listening to you on that. Is it possible if somebody wants to go on a holiday there to rent a boat and do it yourself?
I believe you can rent boats. I'm not sure out on the North Sea side of things, but certainly in the Baltic, it's quite common to be able to rent boats. Possibly from Kiel, you could probably rent to go back down the Kiel Canal into the Eider River. But I don't know, have any information on that.
So you went through Germany, up into Denmark and the Kiel Canal.
Yeah, well, the Kiel Canal was an extension of the Eider River. I had to lock out into the Kiel Canal. So, yes, I joined that, and the big ships just ploughing up and down. It's literally like being on the M1 motorway. It's nothing different, really. That put me into the Baltic. And as you said, I went to southern Denmark, across the whole of South Denmark. Had some nice passages, but I was making time, or trying to make time now, to get across to meet my next crew. So I wasn't stopping too much along the way. I did mostly anchoring to keep moving.
On across the Baltic to Estonia.
Well, I picked up my crew in the south of Sweden in Istad, and then from there across the Baltic to Estonia. En route, I had an EPIRB experience in Gotland, which is a Swedish island, where my EPIRB self-activated in the middle of the night while I was on the marina. And I had an interesting experience with the Dublin Coast Guard trying to explain what was happening.
Because when this went off, it sets off a radar or a satellite alarm.
That's correct, yeah. It's off satellite alarm, and the Swedish Coast Guard came to visit me a few hours later as part of it all. So basically, from there, that managed to deal with that. We got to a small little island in the Bay of Riga. It's an Estonian island, and then down to Riga itself in Latvia.
Which is a major city.
Beautiful major city, an absolutely gorgeous city, fabulous architecture. I would say of all the beautiful cities I saw, I think Riga was my favourite over the whole trip.
So then you went to Finland, and arriving off the coast of Finland, you had another interesting experience.
We're about 10 miles out from Helsinki, flat, calm, perfect day, beautiful sunshine. And next thing, customs boat arrived and hopped onto the boat. Didn't go looking for papers or passports or anything, went straight to the guy on the helm, my friend Johnny, and stuck the breathalyzer in his mouth and asked him to blow into it. And again, they didn't ask for any details or anything afterwards. They just hopped off the boat and went off, and he was happy. We didn't. So strange.
And that happened to you twice.
Funny, both on Sundays, and one arriving to the mainland of Finland, the other leaving the mainland of Finland. So it was a bit strange.
So, okay, so for Sunday, maybe they thought you were picnicking and, you know, had a few drinks at lunchtime.
Something like that, maybe, yeah.
One thing that intrigued me, you had good weather the whole way, even sailing throughout Finland, Sweden.
By and large, I would say we had 80% good weather over the whole trip. The number of down days were few and far between. Time I was in the south of Sweden, I had 4 days of bad weather and a few other bits and pieces. But it was a day here, a day there. But by and large, I had 4, 5, 6 days on the trot of good weather pretty much all the time.
And now when you go from Finland to Sweden, you're going through archipelagos, thousands and thousands of islands.
They say Finland has about 70,000 islands, and they say Sweden has about 200,000 islands. So quite a few of them are condensed into that section between Finland and Sweden, the islands, the Finnish archipelago, and then the Stockholm archipelago are all in that sort of same area. So it's islands all over the place.
What's it like navigating through them?
It's quite tricky, and you do need to have a very good pilot to give you an idea of where you should be going, and then making sure that you do your tracking correctly. Every day I had to advance track on my tablet to keep us going in the right direction, because it was just impossible to be able to follow where you were with the islands. There were so many of them.
You got to Sweden, and you then again went into the internal water system there.
After doing a tour of the archipelago, we went in through Stockholm and out into Lake Mälaren, which is the third biggest lake in Sweden, and I had some beautiful experiences there. It's a very clusters of islands all over the place, so there's narrow channels everywhere, but it was a beautiful experience all the same.
That was towards the end of August last year, and you found things were closing.
Oh, absolutely. We left there to head over to the Gota Canal. And as we got to the Gota Canal, the first place we got to, pretty much everything was closed in it. And then along the whole 5 days that we were on the Gota Canal, any small little place we got to, there was nothing open. The only places that were open were the bigger towns, and they were few and far between on that trip. So it's a strange phenomenon that the end of August is the end of the tourist season and everything shuts in Sweden.
Going through those canals, I noticed as well that you had to take a guide with you.
The Gota Canal, part of the fee you pay, provides a guide every day. So each day we had a different guide, and they very kindly worked us through the canal, through the locks and the bridges, wherever they need to be opened. So that was part and parcel of the fee we paid.
You left Ireland at the beginning of May, and you wintered the boat when?
I got to, at the end of the Gota Canal, the Gota Canal ends into Lake Vänern, which is the largest lake in Sweden and in Europe. And I found a place there after 5 or 6 days searching around to winter the boat. So it's kept now up in the northeast corner of Lake Vänern for the winter.
Do you know
probably when, another winter for the looks of things.
Do you not hopefully you'll get back this summer?
Well, if I get back, I think it'll be just to do essential work on the boat for maybe a week or two and have to leave it again, unfortunately.
It sounds like a beautiful trip.
It was something I had been dreaming about for, as I say, maybe 6 or 7 years, and I was hoping I could put it into effect. And when it came off, it worked out to be far beyond my expectations. I absolutely loved every minute of it. And even though nearly half of the trip I was on my own, it still worked out very well.
Is it something which is in the reach of your average to good sailor with somebody with nav experience?
Definitely they would need to be competent sailors. There's no doubt about it, because it's certainly things like the different types of moorings that they have there take a bit of work to get used to. And I'm an experienced sailor. I found a bit of hard work getting used to them. Plus, when you get into the more complicated areas like the islands and the various archipelagos, it's really, really tricky, and you need to know what you're doing in those areas. But by and large, in the southern part of the Baltic, most competent sailors would get around and enjoy it very easily.
You're giving a series of talks to the Irish Cruising Club on this online.
We have a Zoom group set up, and I've given the first half of this talk already, which was the overall journey, and I'm hoping to give in the next couple of weeks the second part, which would be picking locations along the way, my favourite spots. And other talkers have given nice, interesting talks as well. So the Cruising Association of Ireland are very proactive in this lay-down time.
Thanks to Charlie Kavanagh, and that really sounds like a terrific trip. You can find details of the Cruising Association of Ireland on their website, cruising.ie. The death occurred recently of a man called Donal Dan O'Driscoll, often described as a champion of the Irish fishing industry. He was from Castle Danbair in County Cork, and Lorna Siggins has this tribute to him.
That's the sound of Amazing Grace played on the bagpipes in Castle Danbair, County Cork this week by Damien Turner, chair of the Irish South and West Fish Producers Organisation. He was marking the passing of one of the organisation's founders, Donal O'Driscoll, who died at the age of 86. A champion of the Irish fishing industry is how the organisation described Donal Dan, as it formed a guard of honour to mark his final journey. Donal spent a lifetime on the Atlantic from teenage years and learning fishing techniques from his father, Dan William O'Driscoll, the Castle Danbair Lifeboat Station, Castle Danbair Fishermen's Co-op and the Irish South and West owe their origins to Donal. With Cork businessman Tom Hassett, he also established the Fishing for Justice website almost a decade ago. Donal was a tireless advocate and was fearless but firm in his criticism of state policy on the marine, questioning why successive governments had decided to accept the status quo with the Common Fisheries Policy, when in fact the European Commission had always said that decisions taken during formulation were never intended to be written in stone. Brendan, Donal's son, Sean O'Donoghue of the Killybegs Fishermen's Organisation, and Paul Stevens of Castle Danbair Lifeboat Station spoke to Seascapes about his contribution and his legacy.
Hi, my name is Brendan O'Driscoll. I'm Donal O'Driscoll's son, or Donal Dan as he was affectionately known. I started fishing with my father in 1980. We fished from 1980 to 1989. I clearly remember the first trip I had with Dad. Finished my leaving on a Friday evening, and we went to sea on Sunday night. And we went to Galway, and we fished for 4 days in Galway. And for the 4 days, I had 1 hour sleep. I can clearly remember it. And poor old Dad had no sleep. But they were tough men in those days and took no notice of it, but it wouldn't happen nowadays. But he was a lovely man to fish with, and he taught us, myself and my brother. And my brother was also on the boat at the time, and he taught us so much. He taught us nearly everything we know about the industry. I'd say he often threw his eyes up to heaven, said nothing at all when myself and my brother would be trying to get our own way, and he just said, say nothing. And God bless him, he was a really, really quiet man. He instilled into us as we grew up that a mark of a man was how he dealt with adversity, not how he dealt with success. He said that anybody could deal with success. And he said, always, always treat everybody the same. He was a really, really religious man too. He said he rarely missed Mass on a Sunday, if he could at all. And even up to maybe 5 weeks before he passed away, he was at Mass with me on the Sunday. And he's got to Mass every Sunday. If he's not gone to his Maker anyway, there's absolutely no hope for me or the rest of us. We're humbled, really humbled by the outpouring of sympathy that we've received from all over the coast and everywhere. You know, people have been so good in these tough times. We're only now beginning to realise in what high esteem my father was held in the industry. He got a great send-off here at home. We couldn't believe that the local community and that the South and West, he really, really got a lovely send-off. And we're really grateful to the people for, as they say, pushing out the boat in these tough times. And we just like to say thank you to everybody, and God rest us all.
Sean O'Donoghue, CEO of the Killybegs Fishermen's Organisation. Before I start, I'd like to say how sorry I am that I couldn't attend the funeral like many others who would like to have been there, but due to the COVID situation, unfortunately, I wasn't able to travel. My memories of Donal would go back quite some time, to the mid to the late 80s, when I was wearing a different hat in the Department of Marine. I found that Donal had very strong views in relation to the Common Fisheries Policy and in particular was very active during the Spanish accession and the whole Irish box and the review of the common fisheries policies. We mightn't always agree in terms of this day. He really was a person of tremendous integrity. He held very passionate views and was really to providing a very good representation for the fishermen. I would obviously have met him at various Celtic Sea Herring meetings, which were infamous at the time. I would have experienced him at fisheries councils and many meetings as such. To say I found him very straightforward and very good to deal with. A very successful fisherman in a number of different boats. I'd have to say he has been a great representative and really did believe in terms of trying to better the lot of fishermen in terms of the common fisheries policy. He was really adamant that it needed fundamental changes.
My name is Paul Stevens and I'm the lifeboat operations manager at Castletown Bear. Given Castletown Bear is such a major fishing port, people are sometimes surprised that Castletown Bear Ornella Lifeboat is only established for just over 20 years. Prior to that, prior to 1997, the waters between Mizzen Head and Kinmare Bay, a huge area of water, were covered by Valentia and Baltimore lifeboats. And a series of tragedies, together with years of campaigning, resulted in the Ornellai considering establishing a station here in Castletown Bear. Donal, with his brother Billy's wife Sheila, were two of the key people involved in the establishment and of a station in Castletown. Donal had a wealth of experience as a campaigner for a wide range of improvements in the fishing industry, and he brought that skill to bear on his campaign to establish a lifeboat here. He had a highly developed negotiating skills and liaised with our good friend very closely, Colin Williams, the former Inspector of Lifeboats for Ireland, to acquire a lifeboat in Castletown Bear on a trial basis for a year in 1997. At that time, then, the Ornellai sought to appoint someone to manage the station in a title which was known then as the Honorary Secretary. And Donal was the obvious choice because he had a vast experience at sea. He had expert local knowledge in terms of maritime affairs, and his approach to everything. It was always well thought out. He was pragmatic and calm. And sometimes when people think of lifeboats, they just think of the crew and the rescues. But in every station, there's someone behind kind of running everything. In our case, at that time, it was Donal. You know, he had the responsibility of authorising launches, always ensuring there was a coxswain and crew available, and liaising with the Ornellai and the Coast Guard. And Donal carried out all these functions in an exemplary fashion. And especially the task of setting up a new lifeboat station was particularly difficult because for the first time we're bringing together 20 or so people, many of whom who hadn't worked together, and building them into a cohesive team. And Donal exhibited great leadership in getting this initial team together and gelling the team together. The majority of volunteer crew in the Ornellai are not from maritime backgrounds, and Donal was always very encouraging and supportive to those who had little or no experience. When Donal retired from his position as Honorary Secretary at age 70, he maintained strong links with our station. Sheila, his sister-in-law, who I mentioned, remained a driving force in terms of fundraising. And Sheila's son, Donal's nephew, Brian, was then a coxswain at our station for 17 or so years. And all his children served on the crew at various stages. So there was a strong O'Driscoll tradition in Castletown Bear Lifeboat. After his retirement, Donal remained a strong supporter and was always available to the station for his sage advice and wise counsel. And in paying tribute to Donal, we want to acknowledge, I suppose, firstly, his significant role in the establishment of the station here. But also we want to, I suppose, acknowledge the tone that he established, one of always there being calmness, a sense of fair play and a practical approach to everything. In summing up Donal's contribution, we just want to acknowledge that he always had a steady hand on the wheel. the crew and indeed the station management committee would like to extend, of course, our great sympathies to his wife and to his children. And there was a general air of sadness in our station last week because we felt we'd lost a very good friend to Castletown Bear Lifeboat.
Lorna Siggins with that tribute. And the death also occurred this week of Bill Byrne, who was a long-term contributor to Seascapes. He began with the programme back in 1996 and continued for another 14 years. He died in England with his family. Our sympathies to them.